Today on The Grave Talks, Doctor of the Dead, a conversation with Heather Lee Landon. When Heather Lee Landon was a teenager, she began communicating with her deceased grandfather. It was a peaceful connection, one which would help her through various difficulties in life. Soon, she would discover that her grandfather was not the only spirit she would have in her life. Her studies would lead her to have a PhD in metaphysical and humanistic studies with a specialty in paranormal science. Today, we hear about her studies and experiences on The Grave Talks.
For me, it dated all the way back to when I was 16. We had lived in a house. We had been there probably about 10 years already. And I suddenly started seeing visions of my grandfather. He would appear at the foot of my bed, next to my bed. There have been times where I'd be brushing my teeth and I'd stand up and look in the bathroom mirror and he'd be standing behind me. Always a startle when he would do that. Mm-hmm. And I would see him walking down the hallway. And what intrigued me about this is he had died 11 years prior. And it was weird because he hadn't been to that house. We bought it after he had passed. He had no connection to the house. And why was he appearing so many years after his death? Yeah. And that kind of got me started into researching. You know, back then we had to go to the library with stacks of books. We didn't have the internet to do all of that. And I spent a lot of time, and anytime I found someone who was interested in the paranormal, like when we would go to Gettysburg for our summer vacations, I would corner them and ask 101 questions. And that kind of was what really sparked my interest in the field.
When you look back on that specific experience, your grandfather showing up all those years later, I want to ask you to clarify this. You said you had visions mm-hmm. of this. So were you seeing like a full-blown apparition? If someone else was in the room with you, would they have seen it? Or is this something you feel you were picking up on yourself because of your own abilities?
I think it was a combination of both, because it would start with a dream. And it was weird at first, because I know when I, you know, of course, I went to a psychiatrist for a while to make sure I wasn't going crazy.
Sure.
And I would explain the dreams as almost like a floating head is how he would start appearing. It would be like I'd be in the middle of a dream and he would just all of a sudden appear as a floating head wherever I was dreaming about. Then it started developing into my seeing him just sitting next to me. And I think when he was in my room with me, it was a full-blown apparition and they probably could have seen him. But as far as like being in the mirror, because when I would turn around, he would be there, mm-hmm. or even walking down the hallway, it was more of a shadow mm-hmm. than anything else. So I think it was a combination of both.
And you were a teenager and he had died, you said, like 9-10 years earlier. So you were right. quite young when he died, correct?
I was 5 and we were okay. actually outside shoveling. I was playing in the snow. He was shoveling the back deck. And all I can remember is him falling face first in the snow. And my dad got me out of there as quick as I could. And he had died of a heart attack. And I'm not sure exactly what happened, but mm-hmm. he was gone instantly.
And so you were right there next to him when it happened.
Yes. And I was very close to him, too.
Sure. So prior to having that experience with him all those years later, what was your opinion on ghosts when throughout childhood?
I was always interested. And I don't know why. It was just always, you know, it was nothing that scared me. I never really liked the horror movies back then. But when it came to stories about ghosts, it intrigued me, like Amityville mm-hmm. and all of those stories interested me in the aspect of why are these places being haunted? But I never really did the research I did until after I started seeing them.
Yeah. So where did that research lead you in terms of trying to understand why it seemed that he was triggered to show up at that point in your life, or was it even him?
I firmly believe it was him. From doing all the research that I did, of course, in this field, there's conflicting stories as to why things happen. Everybody has their own theory. It didn't come to me until almost 4.5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. When the theory clicked for me, because, you know, there was always, you know, is he attached to an object? Is he attached to the land? But that wasn't possible because he had never been there. Mm-hmm. And it was a completely different town. So it was kind of like, you know, all the different theories coming in. But my grandparents had a Raggedy Ann and Andy doll that they kept on their bed that my uncle had given to them. And my uncle was my mom's brother, and he was also my godfather. And I was very close to him as well. And he had passed 14 years ago. And I didn't have the dolls because my cousin had them. because the interactions with my grandfather as a teenager lasted up until we had moved to a new house and I was 25. So about 5-6 years mm-hmm. and, or actually a little bit longer than that. But my mom had given the dolls to my cousin at that point, and all of a sudden the interactions with him stopped. And then 4.5 years ago, I was diagnosed with stage 5 kidney disease, and my mom got the dolls back from my cousin and sent them to me because she knew I really liked them. And all of a sudden my grandfather started appearing again.
Oh, wow.
And he was one night, I at that time, I thought my life was over. It wasn't, you know, it was just done, because when you have kidney disease, the only way to come back from it is to get a transplant.
Yeah.
And had a dream that he was telling me it wasn't my time. My uncle was with him. And I woke up and he was on the side of my bed patting me on the arm. And then he disappeared. And after that, doctors don't know what happened, but all of a sudden my blood work started turning around. And now 4.5 years later, I'm stage 2.
Does that happen? I don't know much about that disease, but does that happen? Does it reverse itself? Is there ways for it to reverse itself? Obviously it did somehow, but is that a thing or a common thing by any means?
The most common way to do that, of course, is to get the kidney transplant, and then your body heals itself from that.
Yeah.
But without, I mean, even the biopsy that I had after that vision came back, it was a healthy kidney. They sent it to 4 different hospitals and they all said, why are you sending us healthy kidney tissue? It was weird. It just all of a sudden, and the doctors, you know, you can reverse it a little bit, or at least slow it down mm-hmm. with diet and exercise and changing lifestyle habits.
Sure.
But I did all that, but not as extensively as I should have for mm-hmm. it to change as much as it has.
So what are the doctors, other than being amazed, what do they say?
They just told me, good job. they have no clue what happened.
Did you ever interject to any of them, maybe feeling a little bit crazy, but saying, here's my theory, doc?
No, I didn't. I probably should have, but yeah, no. Because even only one of my doctors right now, because I'm actually having knee replacement surgery next month. Mm-hmm. And my doctor, I talked to her all about the paranormal, but the other doctors, when they hear what I do, they're like, you do what full time?
Yes.
But my knee doctor was like, oh my goodness, that's so cool. And she's like, I bet you view the paranormal shows the same way I view Grey's Anatomy.
Exactly. Yes, I can completely commiserate on that. Where it's like, what do you do? Podcast? What about ghosts? Like that's what you do for a living? Yes, it is. And it's just like, you make money at that? Oh, yeah, good money at that. And they're just like, huh? I know. Either they're really into it, and they're like, you know, oh, I can't wait to listen, or they think you worship Satan. One of the two. Mm-hmm. There's usually not. Yep. There's no middle ground there. Just like, okay. Yeah. Well, how interesting. So you had this experience, you did that, your research into it. It's amazing that sort of thing happened. Do you feel like he's like kind of your guardian angel, for lack of a better term, or he's there, he's kind of looking out for you?
I truly believe he is. Mm-hmm. And whether it's him or not, I actually believe he's been on cases with me, because there's been cases where I've been attacked. And then all of a sudden it was like the activity stopped and the home suddenly felt bright. So it was like something stepped in.
Something stepped in to take the negative away. Wow.
Right.
Very interesting. Because that's something that I wonder about, is spirits interacting with other spirits. And what sort of, you know, what's the rules with that? What's the dynamic of how that works? Because it seems in some cases, the spirits in one location may not even be aware of the others that are there. In others, they seem to be kind of like a happy family or a real dysfunctional family, but they're all aware of each other. And then you also have, you know, the dark type things and then the good type things and all that. But the dichotomy of them working together, what are your thoughts on that as far as interactive spirits with one another? Are there rules to that game? I know it's a very vast subject, but just kind of your rough thoughts on it.
Right. And as far as if there's rules, I don't want to say it would be nice to know, because I don't want to find out for quite some time yet, but it almost makes you wonder, are there set rules. It's something that none of us are going to know until we actually are there ourselves.
Yeah.
But it does seem that in the locations that I've been to, it's a lot of residual energy that I've dealt with, but I have dealt with, I don't want to say demonic because they felt like they were more evil people in real life. And of course, if they're evil in real life, they're going to be evil in the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some locations, depending on the spirits, that they do interact the same way as they would in our world.
Yeah.
Because, you get evidence of, I can't remember who it was that was sharing it with me, but the other day someone was sharing a story with me that they encountered a little girl that said, "Help me, I'm trapped." And then they also encountered that there was a darker spirit there that was holding her hostage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something, you have people like that here in the rear world. So it's kind of like, do they just carry on like they do here, or, are there different rules?
Yeah. And maybe rules is the wrong word as I think about it. Maybe it's more like laws of gravity, it's just like you have no choice in the matter. Like, they just don't see other ones if they can't see them. It's not like, "I'm not allowed to see you." It's more just like, here's just the dynamics of how it works. Like, we inhale air, and we see this or that. Maybe there's just something over there of that nature. But it is always interesting when it seems like something steps in. Did anyone else in your family ever have any interactions or share any stories about seeing your grandfather as well?
No, not until, I know my mom was very sensitive and always said that there was something around her, but she never knew what until recently.
Mm-hmm.
She's been just feeling like something's there. She knows her brother comes and visits her a lot. She's seen him. I know her dog, her old dog, comes and visits a lot. And I can even hear him going down the stairs with his collar clinking as he goes down every step.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she says, "I haven't seen my grandmother, but she thinks she had a vision of her not too long ago. But as far as my grandfather, I don't think she has."
Yeah.
And no one else in my family is either willing to talk about it or have had experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. So what does that say then to us about when we, this is all just conjecture, your opinion only. It's not like, here's the, what exactly happens today. We're going to find out with Heather. what does it say to you about, okay, when you pass on, from all these years of your research and studying, obviously your family and things well beyond it, what do we do? Are we kind of immediately put in this role of, okay, here's how you were in life. You're probably going to continue to be the same person if you want to be. And now your job is to look out for those that come after you for a certain set of time. Or is it a punishment? Or is it a, we just don't really know where the hell to go when we die, other than I'm just going to keep hanging out around here? What are your thoughts on that?
I've flip-flopped on this so many times. I really don't have a set theory or thought on it.
Yeah.
I've gone everywhere from, I truly do believe that in reincarnation that we do come back, but how the process goes, I'm not 100% sure. Like, how long do we, are we in between lives, or do we automatically get recycled? It's obviously we don't, because there are spirits, or, what really happens with our energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird, because it could be, we're staying behind to make sure our loved ones are okay after we're passing. But then how does that explain my grandfather coming back almost 30 years later?
Mm-hmm.
It's everything from, we stay here until there's another vessel for us to take over as part of reincarnation. And then I've also wondered, do we go to another world, another planet?
Yeah.
Are we sent off somewhere else?
That's another thought. Yeah. I'm always interested about this idea. And especially when people are like, and I could have been a cat or something. Like, I don't want to be a cat. I don't want to be a dog. I don't want to be a peacock. I don't want to be fucking anything. I'll be another person. But it's like, feel like my next one, I think I want to be like, no, why would you want to do that? Like, better being the human. Like, what's up with that? it's very interesting to dive into that. So as you continued your research in life on this stuff, obviously having a very impactful experience with your grandfather, what kind of road did that take you down?
For most of my time up until the last 10 years, I pretty much just did behind the scenes work. Research, whenever we would go somewhere on vacation or just travel, I would do everything I could to find out about the paranormal activity in the area. I was probably one of the number one customers on ghost tours just because I would like to ask everybody 101 questions. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of kept all that to myself. It was weird because it was a time where you didn't really tell everybody what you did. And then more recently, I was watching one of the UFO shows and I was like, you know what? I could do this, you know, because I was already, you know, working from home as a freelance writer. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I can turn my my research into writing. And I joined a local team. From there, COVID hit. I ended up leaving that team, creating my own team. And then I ended up joining the Warren Legacy Foundation, where I do extensive research and I also help with their marketing. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of just developed into more than I ever thought it could. I just figured when I first started a few years ago that it would just be a book or two.
Yeah.
And even if those ever got published. And mm-hmm. It was just weird. You know, I never really thought I'd be where I'm at today.
Yeah. Now, Chris is a really interesting guy. I've had him on the show several times. I helped him get the original, the Warren Legacy website up and running. It kind of pushed him in the direction of start talking about this. Do a show yourself. You have stories. And thankfully, he's doing that now. It's the stories there. So obviously, what kind of drew you over to getting involved with Chris and the Warren Legacy Foundation? Obviously, he had an interest in Amityville. So that to me was my initial interest in talking with him years ago.
Yeah, I don't want to say I loved Amityville, but I did. It was always an interesting story. And there's so many conspiracy theories out there. Mm-hmm. You know, were they related to the mob? Were they, you know, was it demonic? Was it just he was a jerk? You know, there's so many different theories out there. It was like near endless research looking into that.
Sure.
And I knew Joe Franke on Facebook. And one day, he had shared a video and Chris was in it. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to reach out, because at the time I was the only person on my team because I had just started it. Mm-hmm. And then it turned into being my husband and my son, so I wouldn't have to go somewhere alone.
Yeah.
And I was like, if I could join the Warren Foundation, then I could expand my, you know, reach as far as if I needed help on a case, there were people to help out with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here I applied, very, you know, little experience in actual the investigation side of it. But with my research experience, they brought me on board, and it's been a roller coaster ride ever since.
Yeah. The amount of stories that that go along with that, and the stuff that he's witnessed firsthand and in some of the, you know, the more famous cases where he was there, was it's always an interesting conversation when I talk to him. So you started getting more involved in it. Did you start doing like home investigations? Where has your research taken you over the years beyond what you're doing for your personal experiences?
Right. My research, more or less, even though I have done home and residential investigations, and I will continue to do them because it's all about helping others, but I find them heartbreaking. So if someone else can do it, I'm more than happy to let them do it, but I'm always there to help if needed. But I tend to like research the histories of locations, and then get us in there to conduct experiments, because my PhD is in paranormal science. So I want to come up with a more scientific process to this field. So I try to look into getting us into locations where we can conduct the scientific experiments and find more about it. And I just love how history fuels the paranormal, and how we can use the paranormal to preserve history. And that's kind of what I did when I wrote my book, Southern Nevada, Haunted Southern Nevada Ghost Towns.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that in a minute. What do you find? What did you find heartbreaking? Do you have any specific situations or cases where you really, you know, that just kind of really resonated with you when you were talking about doing a personal or an investigation for an individual or a home?
Right. Well, the one was it was just before we moved from Nevada to Florida. And I had been helping her with the previous team I was on. And then when I went to the Warren Foundation, she wanted to come with me so that way she could see what the other investigators might have to say. And we weren't finding anything paranormal. We really thought between her medications, her medical condition, that it was tactile hallucinations. And we wanted her to basically get checked up by a doctor to make sure that that's what it was before we continued. Mm-hmm. And she was on the phone with me one night crying for hours saying, she's not crazy. She's not crazy. And I'm like, I understand you're not crazy. I'm not saying that. We just need you to go to the doctor and say, this is what you're experiencing. You know, I feel like something's tugging on my, you know, leg all day long. You know, is there something, you know, medically explainable for that?
Yeah.
And it was just, I got off the phone crying.
Yeah.
Because I felt so bad. I mean, she was 78 years old and I just, it was heartbreaking.
How often do you think it is in cases or just in your experience, really, where you get a call from somebody, they want, you know, so you to privately look at something. They're not out to, you know, get publicized. Where, what percentage would you put it on that there is a mental illness or something going on that either is undiagnosed, refuses to be diagnosed, you know, but it's there and it's really not something paranormal?
I don't really want to say too many. I would say about probably a quarter, 25%, yeah. Only because when it comes to the paranormal entities, at least the negative entities that I've encountered, mm-hmm. are attracted to those who have mental conditions,
yep.
or other illnesses. So it's not so much that what they're seeing is making them crazy or their illness is causing them to see what they're seeing. Their illness is actually attracting. Mm-hmm. And we need to know that so we don't make their illness worse. Because if we go in not knowing someone, you know, is suffering from severe depression, anxiety, or schizophrenia, us playing an EVP of a spirit, you know, could make them, mm-hmm. you know, go even deeper.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the next thing is I would venture to guess that you would feel that a good majority of them maybe do have something going on, but they're being taken advantage of on top of an existing condition. Like, it's not just the condition itself that they're suffering with. There's something else that's making it far worse and also making them not be believed by anyone, because everyone just brushes it off as, well, they got that and that's all that, and everything else is just kind of dismissed.
Right. Yeah. And that's why we need to know. I mean, it's more or less, if, you know, we ask all of our clients before we conduct a thorough research virtually first, with video calls before we ever go to their home, just to make sure we're safe and that they're safe. Mm-hmm. And we do request that they have a medical workup and mm-hmm. also a psych evaluation. And we tell them that, you know, it's not because we think you're crazy. It's not because we don't believe you. We just want to know how to handle your case. And also we want to know what could be fueling your paranormal activity, because there are cases, you know, we just kind of lay it out for them and explain it to them that we just need to know this so we know how to handle the case.
Kind of have a baseline for where you're going to start.
Right.
Yeah. Tell me about your experiences in Gettysburg.
Oh, those are actually some of my favorite experiences I've ever had with the paranormal. The first one that I had, I was at Devil's Den, and it was at the spot with the famous Confederate sharpshooter photo that Matthew Brady had.
Okay.
And I was walking between the rocks, and as I came around the rocks, they were also having a reenactment that weekend. A Confederate soldier walked by me, and he tipped his hat at me and continued walking. And I was like, holy cow, I need to go get a photo of this guy, because I was a photographer back then. Mm-hmm. And as I shot around the rocks to catch up with him, he was gone. And there was nowhere he would have run to. No one else was around. And it was like, you know, what did I just see?
Mm-hmm.
And the more research I had done on that site, it had come out that Matthew Brady's assistant staged that photo. And they pulled the body from the actual Triangular Field battlefield and placed it there and staging it like the Union had killed a Confederate sniper.
Oh, wow.
So that was like, well, is his unrested soul fueling that paranormal activity? And mm-hmm. it was just very interesting the more I researched into that. And if you go through Matthew Brady's photos, you'll find the same person's body in two different photos in two different, completely different locations of the battlefield, at least, you know, 60, 70 yards from each other.
And seeming to be somewhat of a conscious spirit too, if he's tipping his hat to you.
Right. He knew I was there, but he didn't talk. He just knew I was there, was very polite, tipped mm-hmm. his hat, and then just kept going.
And initially when you're seeing this person, you're just thinking it's probably a reenactor. You're not going ghost right away.
Right, exactly. Because he was completely solid.
Yeah.
I mean, he was fully there. And it was, and that's why I was like, oh, I need to get a photo of him. and yeah, he was gone.
At the moment when you had this experience, were you there to try and ghost hunt? Were you just out for a hike? Or like, what was...
Yeah. No, we would go to Gettysburg regularly because my dad just really loved going there. So that was one of our go-to vacation spots.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a photographer because I was just out of college. And I was going around, you know, had brand new equipment, was testing it out, testing all the different settings. And it was just, I was on my own. And it was just kind of interesting.
Sure.
And it's the one time I wish someone was with me so I could be like, hey, but nobody was there.
No, I mean, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and then the other time was we were at Spanglish Spring. And my parents were up on the hill and I was actually down in the spring area. And that's where there's reports of the white lady who is seen, and she's believed to be going there to meet up with her lover that never appeared or never met her because they were going to run away together because he died in battle. And so she still hangs around there, still waiting for him to show up. And while I was there, someone had grabbed my shoulder and pulled me backwards, like almost trying to turn me around. Mm-hmm. And no one was within 100 feet of me.
Wow. It seems like a place where almost anybody could go and your odds of having something happen are quite high.
Exactly. Very high.
Yeah. So did you ever go back there with any, to do any sort of experiments or anything of that nature? Or was these just kind of experiences in younger days when you were walking around with your family and such?
Those are just experiences when I was younger, early 20s. I do want to go back. I do have plans to go back. I just haven't had time to fit it in.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about your first book, The Haunted Southern Nevada Ghost Towns. I'm assuming this is because you were living in the area at the time?
Yes. Yeah, we actually, in 2020, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, late 2020, I was reached out to by a local production company saying that they were looking for local paranormal investigators to go to different ghost towns to film a documentary, which ended up being called Real Haunts Ghost Towns. Mm-hmm. And he fell in love with the idea that my research team was my family. Mm-hmm. So we started all the research on all the different ghost towns. They gave us a list of where they were taking us. And after that was all done, I'm like, well, I just need to turn this into a book because I've done all the research already.
Yeah.
And I sent it to History Press and they loved it. And that's that story. It was, it was actually almost a no-brainer for that book.
Sure. So were these locations that you had done research on in the past, were they new to you or how did that work?
Some of them were new to me, but some of them I had done research on before because earlier in the year 2020, we had filmed a pilot for a TV series in Goldfield at the Florence Mine. Mm-hmm. And we did some extensive investigations there, everything from exploring the mines. We went, one of our investigators went down into the main mine shaft. A couple of us crawled into a collapsed mine area. And then I sat for hours. I was up all night with the mine owner because he's also the local historian for Goldfield. Mm-hmm. And I was a sponge talking to him. I got as much information as I could out of him. And that is a big chunk of the book from all of our research and our investigations there. And then there's a museum in Henderson, just outside of Las Vegas. I know it's not really a ghost town, but they it's a mining museum. Mm-hmm. And they educate children on mining throughout the state of Nevada. And I volunteered there as well. And I had done extensive experiments at that location. Whenever they would be in between tours, I'd be like, hey, can I go back in the mine and do a quick investigation? They're like, go ahead. Mm-hmm. So they put up with my antics, wanting to always try something new.
Sure.
And then Nelson, we had been to several times, not so much for paranormal investigations because they really didn't allow them, but we did get a tour of one of the abandoned mines just outside of Nelson, where we conducted several EVP sessions. We tested out dowsing rods. Because there was no breeze down there, we tested out a theory that I have using a fidget spinner and a couple different things that we did down there as well.
Tell me about the fidget spinner, because that actually seems like a fairly easy to manipulate object that would be good in this area.
It is. It was interesting because I was hosting an event for the mine or the museum that I had volunteered at. We were hosting a fundraising event and we did a paranormal investigation afterwards. And one of the guests said, hey, check this out. And she pulled a fidget spinner out and found a flat rock. And we made sure, she's like, nope, no breeze, no nothing. And she spun it to make sure it freely spun. And she's like, if you're here with us, make it spin. And she's like, and here's how you do it. She showed him, and then she stopped it. And then a few seconds later, it started to slowly spin on its own. And I was like, oh my God, that is so cool. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I carry them. I have, I think, about 10 of them now. And I even, there's one like within my reach, and I'm reaching for it right now, but it actually lights up. So you could still use it in the dark, mm-hmm. and it'll still, you can see it spinning if it starts to spin.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Heather. In part two, what was Heather's goal in getting a PhD in metaphysical and humanistic studies? Also, what kind of experiments has Heather done when studying the paranormal? And does Heather believe that there are demonic forces at play in our society today to blame for some of its current downfall? Those questions and more in part two. Until next time, for all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.